Good afternoon. You're listening to KPFZ 88.1, Clear Lake, Lakeport, and all of Lake County. Stay tuned for Inside Out.
Somewhere deep in the jungle are living some little men and women. They are our past. And maybe they are our future.
Again, it's Tyra St. John with Inside Out, fooling around with the board as usual. And we have a wonderful guest today, someone who's traveled all over the United States and abroad and is now moving into Lake County from Berkeley. His name is Siddhartha Shaw. He says Siddhartha V. Shaw. Is that V important for you?
It's not particularly important. I guess it just adds a little bit more character.
You have so much character, no matter what, that I'm not going to worry about it. But I have met with you and with Carol Dobush, who's in charge of the Arts in Public Places. Both of us were very taken about your knowledge and information and your products that have to do with the sacred art of India. And then you also talk about sacred art and sacred space online. I wanted our listeners to know about you because you're moving into Lake County and you have so much to offer, and I know you're going to be doing some presentations.
Yes.
So,
yes. Well, thank you so much.
So who is Siddhartha? First of all, where do you come from? What's that all about?
Well, thank you very much for having me on your program. Looks can be deceiving. I'm obviously not like everybody else here in Lake County, and with a name like Siddhartha Shaw, that becomes quite clear. But I'm actually born and raised in Lake Forest, Illinois.
I will say for our listeners that he's young and handsome and very, very bright.
Thank you. So, yes, I was born and raised in the U.S., but I'm from Indian parents. My parents moved to the United States in the late 1960s. And while I was raised in the U.S., they always held on to our Indian heritage and traditions and culture. It was very important for them that my brother and myself, we both kind of learn the language of our region in India, that we know the practices, and that we maintain a connection with the culture.
How old is your brother?
My brother is 30. He'll be 37 this year.
So he's a little older than you.
He is, yes.
Right. And where were your parents from in India?
They're from Gujarat, which is a state on the west coast of India. It's north of Maharashtra and Bombay, and just under Pakistan. So it's a region, it's known for its textiles, it's known for its handicrafts, but it's a region of India that many people don't get to visit. And that has its pros and cons, obviously. But the pros are that, you know, the artistic culture and tradition of that region are still very vibrant and authentic.
And is your father in that business?
Not at all.
No.
My father is a doctor. My brother is a doctor. Many Indians become doctors, and I faint at the sight of blood.
Right. So you're not much help in that family.
Not at all, no.
Except in the art department.
Yes.
Came here, Illinois, did you say?
Yeah. So I grew up in a suburb of Chicago. And
which one?
Lake Forest.
Oh, yes, I know.
It's
Lake
on
Forest.
The North Shore, kind
right,
of near
I almost
Evanston.
Moved there one time.
Ah, uh-huh, yes. If you've read the book or seen the film Ordinary People, it kind of talks about the reality of Lake Forest.
Oh, yes.
Which is
oh,
this
dear.
Beautiful exterior and all right. these
sort of
wild
like Scarsdale,
secrets.
New York.
Yes, yes.
right.
So I grew up there, and, you know, even as a kid, I remember my mother saying very, very clearly that from anywhere you stood in our house, she wanted for you to see God and for God to see you.
Mm-hmm.
And
wow.
so all over in the home, our house was really filled with a lot of sacred imagery of many, many different traditions. Now, she is not someone who'd consider herself an art connoisseur, or really, she says she really doesn't value art very much at all. She didn't look at these items as art objects. For her, it was about a relationship with the divine. So I grew up in that context, and then years later, I went on to college. I studied history of art and classics at Johns Hopkins University, focusing on classical Greek and classical Indian art and also 19th century French painting, and then moved to California. I swore when I moved to California that I would never wear a tie, and the word consultant would never be in my job title. And within 2 weeks, I was an art consultant wearing a tie. So my first actual job was selling art.
Right.
And so through the experience I gained from selling art for a major, major art gallery in San Francisco, combined with my interest in spirituality, since 2005, I've left working for galleries or managing galleries. I have my own kind of business right now, which centers on bringing the sacred from the East to the West, educating people about the function of art in Hinduism and Buddhism, and sharing with people the benefits that can be gained from that tradition of art.
And you're one of only two or three people in the United States and perhaps in the world who is dealing with this kind of art on a large basis. Is that correct?
Yes. There are various aspects of sacred art that can be shared with the public. I really specialize. I've got various fields of specialization, but I strongly specialize in contemporary Hindu and Buddhist art of Nepal, of the Kathmandu Valley. And in that field, there are very few of us who are specialized in this area.
And Kathmandu is famous for its Wesak festivals and things like that, isn't it?
Right. Yes, yes.
Right, for some of the esoteric and metaphysical festivals and teachings in Indian, is it Hindu or is it Buddhism?
Yes. Well, Buddhism arose out of Hinduism.
Right.
So one easy way to understand this is in the Hindu tradition, it's understood that there are 10 avatars of Vishnu. Vishnu is kind of the god who is the preserver and sustainer. He walks on earth at times when that's needed. The most recent time when the Hindu god Vishnu was on earth in a human body, Hindus believe, was the historical Buddha. The historical Buddha then began Buddhism. And what you have in areas of North India, areas of Eastern India, and in Nepal is a mixture of the Hindu and Buddhist traditions, both traditions coexisting in harmony, and a lot of crossover in Nepal, in the Kathmandu Valley. The Kathmandu Valley, so Kathmandu is the capital of the country of Nepal.
Okay.
The Kathmandu Valley is filled with extremely important sacred sites for both Hindus and Buddhists. And what the substance of both of these is Tantra. Now, Tantric Hinduism and Tantric Buddhism, Kathmandu is a hot spot for these two sites.
Right. Mm-hmm. How many people live in the Kathmandu Valley approximately? What is the population there?
It is, I believe it's about 2 million now, and I believe it was around 40,000 in the late 50s.
Wow.
So what's happened is, Kathmandu, it's a challenging region for many reasons. As some of the listeners might know, there's been some issues in Nepal in the past with the Maoist insurgency, and what
right.
this did was actually force a lot of Nepalese out of their homes in the villages to safety in Kathmandu, which is the major city of the country, to look for work and look for protection. But this has led to a drastic increase in population. The valley cannot sustain itself at this rate. There's over a 250,000 motorbikes there.
Oh my God.
And the roads are tiny. So combined with the population, adding the pollution that's caused by all these vehicles, including that the Kathmandu Valley is a valley, so it's absorbing a lot of the pollution, and it's placed right between India and China, two major superpowers.
Hot spot in every way.
Yes.
And is the weather also hot there?
It can be. It can be quite cold as well. From the city of Kathmandu, you can see, I believe, 8 peaks that are over 20,000 feet high. So you are at the foothill of the Himalayas there.
Also, refugees from Tibet, probably in the Kathmandu Valley, are they not?
Yes. Now, I'm not sure if this has changed, but the last I heard, you know, India had an open-door policy to Tibetans leaving Tibet. Tibetans were not legally supposed to be in Nepal, although there is a very, very high Tibetan population in Nepal. Many of them have been living illegally in Nepal, but I think the government just kind of overlooks that.
Did you say that Kathmandu is the capital of Nepal?
Yes.
I didn't even know that.
Yes, that's all right.
I always think of Kathmandu as a kind of obscure rural art colony. Like Lake County is sort of beginning to be a little bit, you know.
Well, in some ways, you know, Kathmandu, when people ask me what Kathmandu is like, I say it's a lot like Florence or Paris.
Right.
In the sense of,
it's amazing.
Everywhere you go, there is something to see. The arts have been a major part of the Kathmandu Valley for thousands of years.
And are most of the artists sacred painters of the sacred symbols and goddesses and gods and all that kind of thing?
Yes.
Right.
Most of the work that I deal in comes from the Kathmandu Valley, and of that tradition, all of the artists are originally from Kathmandu.
Right. How many are there of the ones that, what shall we say, the ones who've gone into the profession of sacred art?
Well, this is kind of a complicated, it's more complicated than the question might seem. Now, I'm just going to introduce it briefly by saying this. Many, many Westerners will go to Kathmandu when they're traveling throughout Asia. Mm-hmm. Kathmandu is a place where people go to go trekking throughout Nepal, maybe hang out in a wonderful hippie colony that's there. There's plenty of them, and they're great fun. And what usually ends up happening is that tourists who go to Nepal end up purchasing a tanka, which is a Tibetan painting, or some sort of religious painting as a souvenir.
Right.
Because of the growing tourist market in Nepal, what has resulted is a factory-like setting that's predominant throughout the Kathmandu Valley. You actually have 5,000 to 10,000 painters alone who are producing paintings for this tourist market. Mm. So it's like a factory. Basically, people who've moved in from villages outside of the capital city looking for work, now what they can do is you basically photocopy an image from a book or a museum catalog onto canvas, and then you have an assembly line of people. Someone might work on the face, someone might work on the flowers, someone might work on the postures. But what eventually happens is that A, this is not an authentic painting created by a master. B, the iconography and symbolism gets a little bit screwy in there, so it's not actually functional. And C, it's the decline of the artistic tradition. So on the one hand, you have 5,000 to 10,000 painters in the Kathmandu Valley of the artists who are really doing this with great integrity and authenticity. I would say there are about 15. And of those, at the very top are about 3.
Mm. So there are industrialists who are using these painters to make a lot of money.
Yes.
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. And they're not necessarily good paintings, if at all.
Right.
Hmm. That's just too bad. I told you, a white Tara Tonka from Tibet that I bought in New York years ago. I hope it was before the industrialists got hold of it, because I have no idea whether it's worth anything or not. And it doesn't matter to me because I love it. It's very beautiful. I am very interested in Tibetan symbolism and Tibetan artwork just because I studied Tibetan Buddhism at one time in New York.
Yes.
And I loved it. I was at Columbia University, and it was just something that meant a great deal to me and deepened my Christian faith, you might say,
yes,
in terms of having an inner approach rather than an outer approach, which is Western.
Yes.
You know, instead of Sunday school, we meditate.
Yes.
That kind of thing.
Yes.
You know, not only understand it a little bit, but I appreciate it. And I, my guess is that some of the Hindu meditations are kind of similar in terms of meditating on compassion and all the things that are in some of the other major religions that are for people to overcome their stuff.
Yes,
right,
and absolutely.
And grow in their spiritual understanding of God.
Right? Absolutely. Right. There are various ways in which people from any tradition can benefit from seeing the art of Hinduism or Buddhism or practicing meditation or yoga. You know, many Hindus will say Hinduism is not a religion, it's a way of living. The same right. goes for Buddhism. You know, I don't actually think you can convert to Hinduism. Right. It's basically, you know, every religion has various branches. I would say the intention behind a lot of Buddhist practice and a lot of Hindu practice is to learn to roll with the punches.
Right.
Just learn how to deal with the reality of life, accept what comes, and take pleasure and pain as one, because you can't really change those things.
Right.
So it's the great struggle of all people.
Who's the religious leader in Kathmandu or in
anywhere.
Anywhere.
Yes. Okay. So again, you know, the Dalai Lama is understood. You know, he's probably one of the most well-known figures internationally, but certainly one of the most well-known Buddhist figures.
Right.
Absolutely the best-known Tibetan Buddhist figure.
Right.
And now, of course, the Dalai Lama is the head of one particular sect.
He's become four sects.
Yes.
In Tibet, right?
Yes. So he's become kind of the international spokesperson for Tibetan Buddhism unintentionally
right.
and for the Tibetan people. But there are various other leaders as well in that tradition. The same goes for Hinduism. We do not, there's not one particular leader of Hinduism. There are many, many people who proclaim to be gurus or spiritual
right.
teachers.
Right.
But it's as anyone's guess, as good as anyone's guess to know who's really an authentic teacher and who's really got it and then who's really in it for other reasons, you know. It's a deeply personal
right.
practice.
Is Karmapa one of, His Holiness of Karmapa, is he one of the four leaders in Tibetan Buddhism?
You know, you're getting me on this. This is kind of one of those obvious questions that I should know, and I believe he is. But
Used to be. There were a lot of books that he wrote, I think, that had to do with spiritual materialism and that kind of thing that were very useful.
Yeah, you know, I'm embarrassed to say anything wrong, but I believe that he has an important role in a different branch of Buddhism than the Dalai Lama
right.
actually does.
And right.
That they actually have potential to work together.
Right.
You know.
Right. I'm glad you can't answer something. You intimidate me so much with your knowledge and wisdom about all this. So it's nice for me when you, if I can stump you occasionally. The whole thing is that you fell in love with this art, really, I guess.
Yes.
Is that what happened? When did this happen and why? I mean, how did it all come about?
You know, as a kid, when you're like 6 and 7 years old, people ask you what you want to be when you grow up, and I never had a good answer, but I very clearly remember taking statues out of my mother's cabinets of gods and selling them to myself and using my library card as a credit card and writing up the bill for myself. So
oh, that's funny.
I think somewhere inside me, I always had this desire to do some kind of business, but that aside, to be really engaged in spirituality. But what happened with this particular tradition is that I was managing an art gallery in San Anselmo, Marin. And in 2005, I worked on an exhibition with Robert Beer. Now, Robert Beer is who I consider my mentor, the first Western Tonka painter. He himself is from the UK, but he studied Tibetan painting. And he is the writer and illustrator of the Encyclopedia of Tibetan Buddhist Symbols and Motifs, which is a classic in the field. Mm-hmm. We did a show together where he was exhibiting some of this artwork from Nepal. I completely fell in love with the work. It was and still remains to me the most ultimate form of beauty that exists. To me, the work embodies what beauty should be, what art should be, the most perfect creations by humans today. I saw the work then, I fell in love with it, and basically left my job within a few months to just work with him, mm-hmm. not even really focused on selling, but just really on learning more about the deities, learning more about the tradition. You know, Robert explained to me that being around this work was like entering a cathedral of light, mm-hmm. and that would continue to reveal itself over time. And in the few years that I've been working with him on this project, I can say that the work has transformed my life. And the more I look at the imagery, the more I see not only in the painting, but actually within myself.
Right. I know you're not out to sell things in Lake County necessarily. You will if they're, you know, if someone's interested. You're really wanting to educate people the way you're doing now. I know that's one of your goals because we've talked about
Absolutely.
It. But I think I dare let people know the range of these paintings. I know that someday I would love to have one.
Yes. to start.
unless I write a best-selling book or something like that. It's not too likely. But if I had money,
yes.
I think I would really be interested in kind of going for it. I'm not like other people in terms of my love of a lot of Eastern symbolism.
Yes.
I mean, I just happen to love it. And I've traveled in Japan and China and a few places. I don't know what it is. I'm very drawn to it. But what is the general, you know, what can we expect if we ever really wanted to look at something that we might want for our homes?
Absolutely, sure. What there are is, first of all, there are prints of some of the absolute finest works.
Right.
And the prints are extremely high quality, and they range from about $100 to, I would say, $350 or $400.
But that's not as prohibitive as I thought.
No.
Even prints are better than nothing.
Yes. You know, the goal is just to get the image
into
your space so you can begin working with it.
Right.
The original paintings range from, I would say, about $900 or $1,000 all the way up to, I mean, there is a painting that's $150,000 in Nepal right now, but the range of the work, of a really, really exceptional work, to $15,000, with the vast majority of works of original paintings being priced between $1,500 and $3,000 or $3,500. Now, what people need to understand, you know, as I mentioned before, when I was selling art in San Francisco, I could sell a print by Andy Warhol that he made thousands of, that was not even signed, and I could sell it like that for $8,000 or $10,000,
right,
because of the you know, his name and his recognition,
right,
that's global for people who want to buy it as an investment. Now, with this work, you know, I do often talk about investment. There's great investment potential. There are museums all over the world, but really it's simply about the love of the work. And a painting that would be about $3,000 from Nepal, the amount of work in it would be about 5 or 6 months' work. Mm. So at that point, the price is actually quite good, but it's because we're dealing with a foreign country and a different economy here that the artists are being paid well for their work,
mm-hmm.
and it's still affordable given the amount of time that goes into it.
Are they oils?
Well, the kind of the forefront of the movement in this in Nepal right now of spiritual art is in oil painting.
Mm-hmm.
But there's very few artists who are quite good at oil painting right now. The majority of the paintings are done in gouache, which is basically an opaque watercolor. It's a paint that you can build up and cover surfaces
right.
very, very smoothly and very finely. So most of the paintings are done in gouache. The tradition, early art of Nepal and Tibet, was often done in mineral pigments, which is ground up stones, like using lapis for blue and cinnabar for red. The issue with this is that most of the artists today, they don't actually know how to prepare those colors. The paints have to be purchased from India, and then someone has to train them on how to grind the colors and prepare the paints. So it's basically restricted to gouache and oil.
Right. Does Robert Baer use those kinds of minerals in his paints?
Well, Robert, the interesting thing about Robert Baer is he basically stopped painting. I think it was about 10 years ago. And when people ask him why he stopped painting, he says that he just lost the continuity. So what that means, I guess, is, you know, he's really committed himself to other forms of work, like writing and researching and supporting these artists in Nepal. What I do know is that he has a whole collection of mineral paints at home. And so I believe he was working in mineral pigments because he's shown me the rocks and the powders that he's
right.
worked with.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Where do we begin and helping people without a visual image to see. I just want to say one thing, and I want you to say more about this,
yes.
about the precision and the protocol of a painting so that people will understand the detail and the precision. I mean, just incredible.
Yeah. Well, I think I can sum that up with a quick story about the origin of this modern movement. Basically, in Nepal in the 1930s, there was an artist who was working for the king of Nepal. Mm-hmm. The king showed him a grain of rice, a small grain of rice, on which an artist had painted a four-armed deity, Vishnu, this
right.
god that I spoke about earlier,
right.
on a small grain of rice. Now, Anandamuni, who's attributed as being one of the great grandfathers of this modern movement in Nepal, he saw that grain of rice and took it as a challenge. He went home and later presented the king with a grain of rice on which he had painted the entire kingdom of Nepal. Inside the entire kingdom of Nepal was a temple, and inside of that temple was a perfect four-armed image of this Hindu deity. So I'm sharing that little tidbit to say that, you know, the attention is to detail, and it always has been. You can look at some of these paintings, and you see the sheer beauty of it with the naked eye, but if you actually get up close with a magnifying glass, what you might notice is this bangle that a goddess is wearing that's maybe a quarter inch wide actually has dragons inside of it. There's an image where there's a jewel in the crown of a goddess, and you can barely see it with the naked eye, but if you look again with a magnifying glass, you see that there's this other figure who's kind of holding on to the jewel in the crown. The artists do not work with magnifying glasses. You actually get a very bad headache if you paint with a magnifying glass. It's just this kind of control of the hand and trust in the movement.
To be able to see.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And that's why
you must have wonderful vision.
For some time, if you can imagine, working, spending 3 months, 5 months, 1 year. There's even an artist who spent 9 years on a painting recently. To spend years, month after month, working on very, very fine detail without a magnifying glass, basically around the age of 40 or 45, maybe 50, a lot of the artists, often stop doing some of that fine detail work and turn their attention more to training younger artists and being mentors. But yes, the attention to detail is overwhelming.
It's like the old way Greeks were learning to paint, and they had these, I'm trying to think what they're called,
the icons?
Not the icons, but the places where they painted those classes. Or,
yes.
Or what are they called?
I have no idea.
You don't know? Okay. I can't remember. But anyway, but I think it's wonderful when people are brought along
yes.
in an ancient art.
Yes.
Because we lose a lot of that when we lose those dedicated teachers after.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly. And what we have is actually two significant things happening. We have an ancient tradition that is being passed on from teacher to student.
Right.
You know? So you have artists who are young, alive today, painting work that draws its inspiration from work done 500, 1,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, what you have is a contemporary movement.
Right.
And that's really where my interest is. Of course, I love spirituality. I have great respect for all of the world's traditions. But what really interests me is contemporary movements in art or spiritual art.
Right.
So these artists are actually taking everything they've learned from the past and creating new postures, new compositions, things that attract the modern viewer or even the Western viewer. I find that really, really, really exciting.
And I'm sure you do.
And yes.
I'm sure the people who look at your work appreciate that too.
So yes.
Are most of your customers, the people who buy your paintings, are they major, like, individuals? Are they philanthropists? Are they art supporters?
You've got
supporters?
Everything. You've got everything in there. I have very few Indian or Asian clients, actually,
really?
Which many Westerners are quite surprised by. But you've seen the work yourself. You actually don't need to be from Asia or have much background at all in Asian spirituality or history to simply appreciate the work and
right.
see the beauty in it. So I have clients that range from major, major art collectors to people who just know where they want their money to go. So they might not have a huge budget of thousands and thousands of dollars, but they understand that when they have the money to buy something, what they really want is this kind of artwork.
Right.
Because, you know, I consider myself someone who collects art. It's what's really important to me. And I'm not by any means a particularly wealthy person. But there's artwork that inspires and that we find beautiful, you know. Many things, many forms of art are beautiful. But there's other art forms that actually teach you, transmit, that you develop a relationship with. It's not just about you looking at the painting and getting something from it, but there's actually the painting looking at you as well, which you have through sacred art. So I think a lot of the people who come and see the work that I have, they immediately pick up on that dynamic that's there of these existent beings that are depicted in the right. work, and they want to have a relationship with it.
Right. So it's transcendent in its own way.
Absolutely. Right. Absolutely.
And you kind of have to hang them in a certain place, right?
Yeah, well, you know, there's various ways of looking at it. Traditionally, there would be particular places that the work should be hung. Vastu Shastra, which is the Indian form of feng shui, you could say, really recommends that any kind of meditation or worship or images associated with those things be in the northeast quadrant of the home. At the same time, these are contemporary works. As I've said, that this is kind of a contemporary renaissance happening. The artists are painting these images not necessarily for meditation. You know, we can use them if we want, but they're simply creating beautiful works of art. Mm-hmm. So while a tradition might prescribe you to place it in a certain way and use it in a certain way, the person who collects the work actually is invited to engage in it however they want to and place it wherever they want to.
Right.
You know?
I can understand that some people who are traditionally or even fundamentally Christian or any other fundamental religion might be squirming a bit, thinking, oh, yes. They want us to worship this piece of art or something like that. And could you talk a little bit about the inner changes for anyone at any level, that yes. it's not religious smidges?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it's a big question, and it's something I don't shy away from, but it's something that's really, really hard to understand or explain. As I've said before, you don't need to be Hindu or Buddhist to appreciate this work. I tend to look at these images as archetypes. Now, I know that, you know, if we're speaking in kind of a Jungian context, if we take away the title Hinduism and we take away Buddhism and we simply look at these images for what they are, you might have an image of a goddess who represents the Divine Mother.
Right.
She is loving. She is compassionate. She has a force of blessings that emanates from the image and affects all those who see her. Now, that archetype is represented by the Virgin Mary in the Christian tradition. It's represented by Durga in the Hindu tradition. White Tara embodies some of those qualities as well in the Buddhist traditions. We have to look at these deities as archetypes, as energies that exist. This is why many people who are not Hindus or Buddhists are quite hesitant to consider buying a piece that's a wrathful deity. You know, wrathful deities are very, very common in Buddhism and in Hinduism. You'll have a goddess whose skin is black and sagging off of her bones. Blood is dripping from her mouth. She, there's one form of Kali where she's sitting on a corpse and she's ingesting an intestine from the body of the corpse and putting it into her mouth. Obviously, these are quite demonic, horrific images.
Aye.
But nobody's being asked to worship that image. What we're simply being asked to do is look at that archetype. Basically, Kali in that form represents the crone. Mm-hmm. She is the older woman who has access to secrets, the witch archetype. She is the reality of time, the reality that, you know, everybody's beautiful body isn't going to be beautiful forever. We're all going to die at some point.
Is that why we get angry when we get older?
I don't know about you. I'd get quite angry at this age. I'm only 31. But it's possible. You know, one of the biggest challenges, there's actually deities who represent this. I was speaking to somebody the other day and showed them an image of a goddess named Varahi. Varahi is a boar-headed goddess. She's considered a mother. She's a protector. There's something beautiful and elegant and strong about her posture, but then she's got this kind of atrocious boar's head. And my understanding of that is she represents power and strength, the illusion of beauty. Kind of, she represents beauty and ugliness.
Okay.
In the same way that Kali represents the reality of time. So these shadow images, we have to own them. We have to own them. You don't, again, have to worship a Buddhist wrathful figure, but you can look at the image and have that inquiry, you know, what about this rage or wrath exists in me?
Right.
You know? And one other thing people need to understand is a lot of those wrathful deities, they're not demons. They're actually considered protectors. So someone like Kali, many people know that the Hindu goddess Kali with her tongue hanging out and blood all over her mouth. I tend to explain this to people as with the example of, let's say you're walking in the woods alone and you come across a baby bear.
Right.
You know to run away. Why? Because the mother bear is going to get you.
Right.
You know, the mother bear is the thing to really, really fear. And you know, she's going to protect her child at all costs. So a lot of these mother goddess images, they're not just soft and gentle and compassionate like White Tara or the Virgin Mary. Mm-hmm. Some of them are extremely fierce because they will kill to protect you.
Mm-hmm. So there's this aspect of humanity that is noble in an angry way as well as in the compassionate. I mean, when I was doing my meditation, it was for compassion.
Yeah,
I used to meditate over, you know, if I saw a cockroach in New York City.
Yes, yes, yes.
and they disappeared. They didn't come back. I just didn't want to kill one. I didn't want to, that's not the tactic I wanted to get rid of them. So, you know, they just went away.
Yes.
And Kali kind of character is a fearful one for us looking at it because we don't really want to look at that stuff inside ourselves, our rage. And when we're kind of irrational, we don't like something, we wonder, why is it happening? And we usually turn to prayer or to some other meditative state in order to help us calm down. It's a natural state, but it is not a pleasant state.
Exactly. And
it's a harsh state to be in.
But the importance is in being there. You know,
right.
I have a view of spirituality that is maybe different from many, many people out there. And maybe it's not the right view, but in my opinion, in my experience, leading a spiritual life does not necessarily mean being happy all the time.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't mean being calm all the time. It means being with what is, basically. And, you know, yes, I can definitely, when I get angry and I get worked up, I can definitely benefit from meditating, calming myself down, inquiring into what's really triggering me.
Right.
There's also a benefit to questioning that anger and allowing for that anger to be there. You don't need to act on it, but it's real, you know?
Right.
There are some people, for example, meditation. Meditation, you know, anything can be integrated into a spiritual process and then also be used to bypass real spiritual work. And I know, you know, one example is somebody I knew who was really, really into meditation. And anytime a real conflict or real problem in life would come up, he would simply close his eyes and meditate.
Mm-hmm.
And my response to this, you know, maybe it wasn't the right one, was, you know, this, the stuff going on in your life is your meditation right now.
Right.
Don't close your eyes. Don't take the Tylenol right now. Be with what's really going on
right
here. And some of these wrathful deities actually help embrace that, you know.
Well, that's very Jungian.
Yes.
Yes. To actually deal with it rather than stuff it.
Yes.
But it's still a difficult concept for us to accept in ourselves because we like to think of ourselves as pretty and comfortable and easygoing and
yes
rational.
Absolutely.
Right.
And it's not the easier path. I mean,
no.
I'm not sure what the easy path is, but to actually sit with your anger or sit with your embarrassment or sit with your disappointment in yourself.
Right.
To work through it, but to be ruthlessly honest about that.
Well, if we look at the Old Testament, the Judeo-Christian ethic that we have here in this country, and our history. And then there's a lot of violence in the Old Testament. And there's violence in the New Testament.
Yeah.
And there are contradictory statements. And, I mean, Christ himself didn't put up with too much nonsense when someone else was being hurt.
Yeah.
He sacrificed when he was being hurt.
Yes.
But he didn't. He sacrificed for other people. It wasn't really only self-serving.
Yes.
And we were told in that context in Christianity to get down in the trenches.
Yes.
You know, serve the people, the lepers, and the other people who were not accepted by humanity.
Yes.
And then that was proved, of course, with the crucifixion. That wasn't too pretty in itself.
Right.
If we're looking at humanity.
Well,
here comes a nice guy along and wants to teach us a bunch of stuff. And then, you know, oh, well, let's kill him because we don't agree, or he's going to upstage us or whatever.
Yes. Yeah. You know, there's no way of avoiding the shadow.
Right.
We just can't. And every spiritual tradition, I believe, will have a shadow to it as well. There is the light and the dark. Who was it that wrote about the dark night of the soul? You know, this is kind of
St. John of the Cross.
Yes, you know, right. this is present in the Christian tradition as well.
And recently, Thomas More has written a book on that also.
Yes, yes. Right. And so every tradition has a shadow aspect of it, because we can't evolve without embracing that. We cannot leave that behind or for other people in our lives to deal with,
right.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
Now, speaking of the image of the crucifixion, you know, I would have friends who would come to my house in Illinois and see these blue gods with, like, their many arms or their many heads, and just be a little bit blown away and not really know what to make sense of it, and sometimes scared of the images. And at the same time, I can remember going into a church and seeing a crucifixion for the first time and really being in awe and having great fear at seeing Jesus bleeding and suffering on the cross.
Right.
You know, the image of the crucifixion speaks of a shadow. It speaks of pain and sorrow and suffering and the need for compassion. That is exactly what the art of Hinduism and Buddhism does as well, you know.
And the sacrifice that is implicit.
Yes.
With that. Uh-huh.
Yes. It's like, you know, Christ's suffering is very much like the Bodhisattva's vow.
Right.
The Bodhisattva's vow in Tibetan Buddhism, basically for the listeners, a Bodhisattva is a being who has the potential to be freed from this wheel of suffering that is life and death in the Buddhist tradition. And yet, while they have the possibility of being freed and enlightened and free forever, they have taken a vow to come back again and again until all sentient beings, including humans and plants and animals, until all beings are freed of suffering. That is a great sacrifice as well, you know.
Right.
So it's in contemplating these images, contemplating the crucifixion even. I'm speaking about Hindu and Buddhist art because that's what I specialize in. But we can bring in the image of Christ or mother and child from the Christian tradition and
right.
say, don't just look at these images as familiar symbols that we see all the time. Actually, try to be in relationship with those images and mm-hmm. see what's being communicated through those forms.
And those soul images that we see on television of mothers crossing a desert with a child
yeah.
and protecting the child and being hungry and practically gone herself
yeah.
and still have that great instinct of the mother and trying to protect and hold and care for her child.
Yes.
So all of these images are quite beautiful when we look at them from the right perspective. I don't want our listeners to think that all of the images, or even most of the images, are these wicked demon things. But there's so many that are just absolutely exquisite in other ways. They're pointing out the, you know, the divine attributes that we can aspire to, and hopefully that we are helped with by these archetypes.
Yes, absolutely.
I can't remember the exact paintings. There were so many that we got to see of your work. Well, for example, there's one of the women, I don't think it's one of the Taras at all, mm-hmm. that has many arms.
Yeah.
And I used to think, oh, that's weird, you know, what's all this creepy stuff going on? And then I realized after studying a little bit that those arms represented her many ways of giving and serving and, you know,
yes.
all those kinds of things.
Yeah. We can almost look at these things as, you know, I think probably more Westerners are familiar with Greek mythology than
right.
they are with Hindu mythology.
Right.
Now, the thing is this, is that the Greek religion, the Greek mythology and Greek ancient Greek religion are one and the same. I mean, it's like the mythology is of their gods and goddesses, and that's right. who they worshipped. The thing with Hinduism is it's just like the Greek mythology, except it's not a dead religion anymore. It's still alive. It's right. as if people in Greece would still worship Aphrodite or, Aphrodite or Dionysus or right. Zeus, you know. So these images that we have of compassionate beings or beings with many, many arms, we have to look at them like stories, you mm-hmm. know. The myths of Hinduism read like science fiction, exciting tales, you know. So on the one hand, our logical mind might think, wow, how can somebody have 18 arms? Right. On the other hand, if we just think of it like we're watching some great movie like Lord of the Rings or you know, something with a lot of special effects, it makes perfect sense. It's just an image. It's an image, you know? There's right. power in that image. The goddess with 18 arms, with weapons in each arm, because she's there to destroy the demon who's going to destroy the world, right. you know? What a great image. At that right. point, we're not even thinking about, well, the woman couldn't have 18 arms. We're just in the story, right. you know? And so these paintings are basically representations of these stories. Right. And we can inquire into the symbols, but more than that, there's just this sheer awe that happens when people look at the work.
Right. It's absolutely stunning. It's moving from an inner place.
Yeah. I have yet to meet somebody who has seen the paintings and not been somehow affected by them.
I know that you are going to, at some point, do some presentations here, perhaps with the help of Carol Dobusch or others that work in the arts community. And I would certainly like to be a part of that, if at all possible. I'd really like to see that happen.
Because
it's a very uplifting idea. Exquisite. I mean, I just feel we're honored to have you here.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. So
do you have any plans for that yourself? I want you to, first of all, give your website. Believe it or not, that clock is a little off. And so by our clock on the board, we have about 6 more minutes.
Okay.
I wanted to know, you know, what possibilities you see for sharing this in Lake County.
Well, you know,
Northern California.
Sure. As I've told you, you know, I moved to Lake County in July, and I'm in the process of a move. I'm moving from Lakeport to Kelseyville right now. This has been my home base, whereas I've gone to different cities around the U.S. and Asia to meet with my clients and collectors. So I haven't had a focus on sharing the work to sell in Lake County, but I am very committed to educating people here. I really want for Lake County to be my home, and I want to share what I have with the community here. I have no immediate plans for that, although I am always, always happy to show people the work, to spend time with them, explaining who the deities are and the history of the paintings. So one way to get in touch with me is through my website, which is www.tantricart.net. That's TANTRICART.net. I can also be called at 510-225-8183. And, you know, most of how my work goes is as I do lectures and I do presentations about the importance of art and spiritual transformation, what the divine feminine is, the history of this art. But a lot of it also comes through just individuals wanting to meet with me and spend a few hours looking at the art, like you and Carol did coming to my home, you know. That's how I work. It's as simple as that.
Well, it was a rare and wonderful treat. I hope other people will do that too. For our listeners, before we finish, you may want to go get a pen. I have suggested that everybody keep a pen and pad beside their radio so that when all these goodies come across, you'll have a way to access them. So we'll be giving out that website and telephone number again, Siddhartha V. Shaw, if you want to call him or email him. That will be something you might want to look into. Have you met other artists here in Lake County?
I've met a few, actually. I had a few really lovely interactions with John Clark, who does many of these beautiful paintings on silk in
right.
Kelseyville. And then some friends of mine who are kind of painting too. But that's the thing. I would love to meet artists in Lake County because it's often artists who can really appreciate what's going on in these paintings from Nepal. People who've painted for 50 years, and then they see one of these paintings and they just cannot understand how any any human could possibly paint like that. So I would love to meet more artists here.
So whether they're beautiful, gorgeous, perfect paintings in the traditional sense, or whether they are wrathful demons in another context, they all have this, like, from top to bottom, there's a certain number of inches or things like that, and the eye has to be in a certain angle or position to every other thing in the painting, right?
Yeah. Yes.
They have to be precise in exactly where they are on the page and how they relate to each other.
Yeah.
And it's old, old, old knowledge and wisdom, isn't
yes,
it, that comes
exactly.
from?
Exactly.
And can you give us a little more detail about that? Because it's fascinating.
Well, what you have, I'll do it pretty quickly. The Tibetan tradition of painting, Tibetan Tonka painting, there's a very rigid system of proportions and measurements and calculations that go into painting a Tonka painting. So what you don't see, when you see the image itself, you might see this Buddha or this white tara. What you don't see underneath the image is this complex grid and system of lines and angles. Mm. So when you're meditating on that image of the deity, of the Bodhisattva, the language of proportions that's underneath the image is going into your psyche and transforming you, is the understanding in Tibetan Buddhist art, Tibetan Tonka painting. Now, with the Newar art, which is the art from Nepal, they do follow artistic traditions of proportions and measurements, but a lot of that is actually informed by the Italian Renaissance. What is different about the Nepalese work from the Tibetan work is that they are more theatrical, they're more dramatic, they're more innovative. So whereas the Tibetan paintings have this rigid system of proportions and are meant for meditation, the paintings from Nepal are much more intended as a window into the beauty of the gods and goddesses in the right. world that they live in.
And those who don't know what a Tonka is, would you explain it, what it is?
A Tonka, it's basically a scroll painting. It's what's common in Tibet and in Tibetan Buddhism, a painting of a figure or multiple figures, or a mandala, which is kind of a wheel with symbols inside of it, that is often brocaded in silk and hung on the wall. So these paintings are intended for visualization practice.
Right.
Which means you have your Tonka painting, the scroll painting hanging. Let's say it's white tara. You look at white tara. You see what she looks like. And then you close your eyes, you meditate, and you visualize her with your mind's eye.
Uh-huh.
And that is how art is used in Tibetan Buddhism. Whereas in India or in Nepal, with this Hindu and Buddhist art that's not of the Tibetan tradition, the images are just about beauty. It's about beauty. It's about celebration. It's again a window into the reality of the gods and goddesses.
That's a precision. It's a reflection of the precision in the universe.
Yes, and they are sacred mirrors, you know.
Right.
They
right.
are intended to also be viewed as mirrors. What you see also dwells within you.
Right. And so sacred space, in your context, you deal in sacred art and sacred space.
Yes.
Is having places in your home like your mother taught you.
Yes.
Which is everything, every place you are in your home, you can see God and God can see you.
Yes. Yeah, so the right. name of the formal name of my business is, you know, my name. It's Sacred Art and Sacred Space. And it's basically pointing attention to how introducing sacred art into your home literally affects the energy of the space and can create a sacred space.
Right. I see our other programmers are gathering to come into the studio, so we have to close our show. It is a wonderful treat for me, and I hope for all of our listeners that you were able to join us today. And said Arthur V. Shaw, we welcome you back when you're able to come.
Thank you
and
so much.
And if I can do anything to help you acclimate here in Lake County, I'd be glad to do so.
That's great. Thank you.
So it was quite an education. And I also want to refer you to the woman in our Foundation for Cultural Change, which I think the two of you would get along quite well.
Wonderful.
And really enjoy each other. So hurry back.
I will. Thank,
thank
you.
Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Bye-bye. This is Tyra St. John signing off for Inside Out, and stay tuned for Our Stories, Our Lives.
Somewhere deep in the jungle are living some little men and women. Our past and
Jerry Charlie, yeah, 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 ah, yeah, 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 Jerry Charlie, yeah, 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 yeah.